Let's remember together some of the greatest TV and movie stars of yesteryear with the woman who knew them. Mary Jane Popp hosted radio and TV shows for nearly 5 decades, meeting these stars and getting them to share their real-life stories. You'll meet them up close and personal as Mary Jane searches her extensive archives for the best and brightest real star talk on Pop Star Talk. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
Time to walk back in time with some of the famous and sometimes infamous personalities of our time on Pop Star Talk. I'm Mary Jane Popp, along with my Pop Star Talk producer, Kenneth Segura Knoll, as we traverse the lives and stories of some of my most favorite interviews that I've done over the last 5 decades. Hi, Ken, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Good morning or good afternoon.
Okay. It's that time again. So let's begin. I have a curiosity. By any chance, are you a Trekkie or at least a Star Trek, the original series fan?
I was not a big fan, but I watched it. Yeah.
Okay. It's so funny because I didn't watch the first of the series, which I think ran from 1967 to 1969. There were 79 episodes. That's it. But it was the second series because I was doing club work and I wouldn't get back till like 2 o'clock in the morning. And you know how it is, Ken, you don't feel like going to sleep after you've done a show and you're fired up. The adrenaline is still rolling. And so I would just turn on the TV and guess what? It was the reruns of Star Trek. And I loved watching it. I got hooked the second time around when it was in reruns. And the characters were just so unique. I'm surprised it didn't go on, but it wasn't popular when it first went on, was it?
I don't, you know, it was very popular with everybody that I hung out with, you know, so it was a constant people talking about Star Trek. But the interesting thing, you'll think this is funny, but I played in a band, and the mother of one of the guitar players decided we should have uniforms for the band, you know, and she bought us these shirts and they looked just like the Star Trek shirts. And people would make fun of us. What are you, the Star Trek band?
you notice what I have. I'm going to hold this up to the camera. Is this significant?
Yes.
Star Trek. I've got my Star Trek shirt on.
That's right. That's right.
And why? Because we've got a special guest today. That's why.
And that symbol meant what?
It was just meant Star Trek.
Just
everybody had that symbol.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That and when you saw that symbol, everybody, you know, would go, you know, with the fingers like Spock used to do, right. Separate the fingers.
Yeah.
I have to push my fingers into place. He always was able to.
I can't do it because my little finger is already out there, see. So
oh, okay.
That's a sign of intelligence, I'm telling. I've been told.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I love it because, and believe it or not, the Star Trek, the original series, is still running today. You will find it someplace, you know, WeTV or MeTV. I love it. I've seen the episodes over and over and over again, but it was such a good team. It had a chemistry. That's what was so special about it. And they all seemed to do really well on the series and went on to do other things. And the guest that we have today is even more so because he's done it all. But instead of my telling you about it, I want him to tell you about it. So on this episode of Pop Star Talk, I found my interview with Chekhov. He played Chekhov in the original series. That's Walter Koenig. And I love that he was so honest about his time with the series that only ran, like I said, from 1967 to 1969 and is still loved today in reruns. Probably gonna run forever.
These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
I'll tell you, that sound, that music has been a mainstay for decades. But this man has worn many, many talented hats, from stage to television to the big screen. And yes, you probably remember him fondly as Ensign Pavel Chekhov on the original Star Trek TV series. And also
Babylon 5. But Walter Koenig has been busy from day one, from the day that he dreamed of becoming an actor. He's produced several films, he's a teacher, a prolific writer, too, and his latest book is Beaming Up and Getting Off, Life Before and Beyond Star Trek. His name, of course, Walter Koenig. Walter, what a pleasure to have you with us on Pop Off.
Oh, thank you so much, Mary. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, you betcha. I know, everything is well with you with this pandemic and everything? You're staying well?
Yeah. I'm happy to say I don't know anybody personally who has suffered the consequences of this terrible pandemic. So I'm pleased that my circle of friends are so far unaffected by it as well.
Fantastic. Now, you have done so much. You know, I was looking at all the material and I thought, my gosh, where do I even begin? But you have written science fiction. You've done Star Trek, big and small screen. You've just done it all. And is there anything that stands out in your life more than anything else? Or is it just kind of like what came to you? You did it.
There are probably some roles that I've played along the way that have been more satisfying and I consider highlights, I guess, in my career.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're probably more relegated to the stage than they are to film. And I think very fondly of those opportunities. I played Scrooge in Christmas Carol for 5 years.
Wow.
I did a play by Jules Feiffer called The White House Murder Case, which was a very dark comedy and had a great deal of fun doing that. I played in another very dark comedy called Steam Bath, where I played God as a Puerto Rican towel attendant. That was a delight. I've had those opportunities. I did a melodrama called Night Must Fall, where I played a bellhop who was psychotic and carried around a woman's head in a hat box.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? Doing stage, I don't know, there's something magical about doing stage because it's immediate. It's not like, you know, being in front of the camera, which, you know, by the time they do the editing and all that kind of stuff, you get your immediate response from that audience, don't you? It invigorates you.
Yeah, it certainly is that. You occasionally are surprised by what you see of a performance when it's on celluloid or on tape. Wait a second, I don't remember that. Or, they left this out or something of that nature.
Yeah.
But theater is an immediate reaction. It's either immediately rewarding or immediately punishing, depending on how well you perform. And for the most part, I've found that thrilling and the most satisfying exercise of my craft that I have accomplished.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, did you ever imagine that 3 years, it was, what, 79 episodes of Star Trek? It's still running today, for gosh sakes. Did you have any inkling that it was going to become that iconic, that classic?
No, of course not. Nor did anyone else. I can say that without a qualification. When we were told in the spring of 69, I believe it was, that the show had been canceled, we all assumed that was it. That was our career with Star Trek. And now what did we do with the rest of our lives? It just seemed like it was a fait accompli. That we were brought back, and there were so many false starts in our returning.
Yeah.
We were going to do another television series. Nope, we weren't. We were going to do a B movie instead. Nope, we weren't going to do that. back and forth until actually when we were actually given a start date, that was postponed for like 6 weeks or something. So it was... It was a very
rocky ride.
Qualified enthusiasm with which we approached the work. I don't believe that I thought the film was actually going to eventuate until we got into the second shot. The first shot, I thought, well, they could still cancel it.
I can imagine. Well, 7 movies were made from the original, right?
Right. Well, 6 movies, and then Bill and Jimmy and I were invited to perform in the Next Generation film as well. So we did the 7th film.
Amazing. Now, you know, it's so funny because Chekhov, of course, was Russian, supposed to be Russian. You are of Russian descent, aren't you?
I am, certainly, yes.
So
it would have been wonderful. In fact, that one of the things I truly regret, is that my father didn't live long enough to see me perform as a Russian, because he was really devoted. His first loyalty, I think, beyond any, was to his Russian heritage.
No kidding. It sticks with you. Like you're obviously a second generation or first generation born here.
I'm a first generation American. Yeah.
Okay. I'm a second generation, and I'm Romanian by descent. It still stays with you. You know, it hangs with you.
Sure.
You know, the food and the music and the dancing and all that doesn't go away. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what this country is about.
You bet. You bet. Absolutely.
Now, you also played a bad guy, Alfred Bester, on Babylon 5. Which part did you like best? You like playing the good guy or the bad guy?
Well, you know, it really, you have to consider one's perspective. As an actor, I don't label the character as being a bad guy. If I'm doing that, then I'm editorializing. And my responsibility is to commit to believing in the character. Because if I believe in the character, then so will the audience.
Oh, sure. No, that makes good sense. Now, how did it all begin? I mean, did you always want to be an actor?
No. As a matter of fact, I'm just waiting for this landline to stop.
Oh, sure. Don't worry about that. That's just in the background. That's okay. That's what live radio is all about. So not to worry. But seriously, I mean, you didn't want to be an actor, or it was just came to you by accident? How?
Well, I was sort of an introspective kid, a little bit on the shy side.
Yeah.
did not excel academically. I really didn't feel that I had an aptitude for anything that was specific enough to want to pursue at an early age. I did discover that when I was on the stage, I got a very positive response, and that goes back to when I was 8 years old and I was. And I was at an adult camp, and I was the only kid. And then in 6th grade, I did the lead in the school play. And then in my sophomore year in high school and my senior year in high school, again, I performed in the lead roles in the plays that we did. And then again, as a freshman at college.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that were good signs, but they weren't enough to convince me that I could achieve any success as a professional actor. So I pursued an academic curriculum that would have probably ended up as a psychologist. I got my Bachelor of Arts in psychology.
Really?
But I did take one course as a diversion, as something to do apart from academia, and that was an acting class. And I had a professor at UCLA who was very enthusiastic about my ability, and felt that I had a shot at becoming a professional actor. And as a consequence of his advice and his encouragement and his writing a letter to a drama school in New York that he was a representative of, I went back there and studied at the Neighborhood Playhouse. And it was then that my fate was sealed. I decided that this was really the only path for me.
How did your mom and dad respond to that?
She wasn't happy about it, only because that meant she had, and I had grown up in New York and finished college in California at UCLA. And then she had come out, my father had passed away, and then she'd come out and bought a house. And when she heard that I was going to return to New York to study drama, she was a little upset, But she was always encouraging.
And she
was supportive.
Good.
So, now, I didn't have any problem there.
Now, you grew up, obviously, in the 50s. So did I. And, you know, we were under this thing called the Cold War. A lot of things happening, you know, the Korean War. And then, of course, you know, the Cold War that lasted forever. And then Vietnam, et cetera. Did any of that influence how you would portray your character on Star Trek? The fear, you know.
No. I don't think it directly influenced how I played my character on any show. Okay. However, you know, the sum of one's experiences do come into play when one starts to delve into a character they're going to play. You know, you become reflective and introspective, and you say, how do I relate? How do I relate to this character? What is it in me that I can, that resonates? What is it in the character that I'm about to play that resonates with me? If you can't do that, if you can't find within yourself if you can't personalize it, then the chances are you're going to be imitating and faking and pretending. And you want to make the performance as viable and as real as you can. So you want to make it as truthful as you can. So I really don't think in terms of, unless I'm doing something very campy and very broad, I don't think in terms of good and bad. I just justify the behavior. When I played Bester in Babylon 5, mm-hmm. I certainly didn't think of him as a bad guy. I thought of him as somebody who was very supportive of his people, who felt that there was a considerable amount of prejudice directed toward telepaths, and that he needed to support them and be their defender. So that's the only way you can approach, I think, a character and make the audience believe you. If they boo and they hiss, all the better. But I never took the position that I was playing a bad guy.
Gotcha. You know, you've done so many television series. I mean, you did the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, Mr. Novak, Ben Casey, Gidget, I Spy, Mannix, Medical Center, The Virginian, Ironside, Diagnosis, Murder, Columbo. Incredible repartee of different personalities that you had to do. I would think it's easier if you stay in one character on a series for a long period of time. Instead of jumping to all these, you have to get into the body of other people over, 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 and over again.
I think an actor's responsibility is to challenge himself and to broaden and expand his talent or his potential as much as he can. I've always looked at playing a character that with which I was not immediately familiar with as an exciting opportunity. The more different than my exterior personality than the one that I showed the world, the more fun it was. That was always the idea of digging in and finding out what was inside you that you perhaps had not examined, mm-hmm. that you could bring forward. The perfect example of that and the most invaluable lesson that I learned in drama school had to do with something very similar, very much along those lines. I was doing a scene from a play by Clifford Odets called Golden Boy. And the scene involved a boxer who had bad eyesight, who had an eye condition. Mm-hmm. And when I read the script, I immediately related to the eye condition because I've always had to combat a self-image that was not as strong as perhaps I would have liked to have been. And so I think of the character's defects. And that's what I can relate to, is the defects. And I had a professor, an instructor, a teacher there at the school, who took me aside one day and said very candidly, "Walter, your personal comment in life is self-pity." And I heard that, and I was floored. It just knocked me off my feet. But immediately, it resonated. Immediately, I said, "My God, he's right. That's exactly what I do." I didn't have to take the time. I didn't have to justify it or rationalize or do anything. It just struck such a chord, such a responsive chord in me, that I knew that is precisely where I feel most comfortable, is when I can play a part sensitively, quote unquote, you know. And I was obviating what one of the principal characteristics of this character, and that was that he was a pugnacious, out front guy who was ready to take on the world. And when I realized that, I said, "No, wait a second. Can I find that? Can I find that in Walter Koenig?" And when I realized that, yeah, that's there, as it is in all people. All these multifaceted character elements are in all of us. We just by virtue of habit or comfort, we settle on seeing and perceiving the world and dealing with it in certain ways. Arrogant people deal with it in an arrogant way. Yeah. Pugilistic people will deal with it another way. Amicable people will deal with, you know, of course, there's always shades and subtleties, but we have a tendency to do what is most comfortable.
Gotcha.
And that's the message that we give off. But an actor has the opportunity to examine the whole width and breadth of our personality and has license. Now that's the important word. We have license to expose those.
Oh,
we're asked to do that on the stage and on film. We're asked to play the people who the audience might consider reprehensible or distasteful or antagonistic or you know, any other negative facet,
sure,
of personality that is part of us. As well as the brilliant, happy, generous, amorous side as well. And that's what acting is about and what makes it so appealing, I believe.
Absolutely. Hey, Ken, one thing that I found fascinating is that he was unfamiliar with science fiction before being cast on Star Trek. He didn't have any interest in it. And he was only one of two actors to audition. And he was cast as Chekhov almost immediately, primarily because of his resemblance to, are you ready for this? Davy Jones from the Monkees, the band of the Monkees.
Well, I see that now that you mentioned
it. Yeah, and Gene Roddenberry, who is the show creator, actually hoped that he could increase the show's appeal to young people. So that's why he was cast almost immediately. Of course, it was great that he had that Russian descent,
right,
because he could get the accent okay. Yeah. And then I also found out that the studio's publicity department, as always, they did something wild. They falsely ascribed the inclusion of Chekhov to an article in the Russian paper Pravda that complained about the lack of Russians in Star Trek. And so you never know what everybody's going to say, right?
Right. He did look very young on the series.
When you
watch the episodes, he was almost like teenage looking at times.
And of course, that, you know, being Chekhov followed him all his life. He used to say, you know, when people meet him, they don't see him, they see Chekhov.
Right. Which, you know, he only 2 years on the series or 79 episodes, but there were 6 movies that were made after that. And look at all of the ones that followed, the Star Trek The Next Generation, Voyager, Deep Space Nine. It was just, it's going on, and probably something else will come up pretty soon again, something new, right?
Right. I don't know if maybe in the next part of it, but he did have a sad thing happen to him. I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And he didn't really talk about it, but you and I will talk about it after the next segment. Okay. However, I have a little secret I'm going to share with you. I've never told anybody this. I had a little crush. Now, this was way back when I first started seeing the reruns of Star Trek, the original. Who do you think I had a little crush on? Who do you think? Who would you guess?
Well, I'm going to go way out on the line and say Spock.
Yep. You got it. It was because he was the brainiac. He was the one who was the smartest of the group. He had all the information all the time. And Kirk always got, you know, all the information from him before he could make any decisions about being the leader. But, you know, Walter was also very, very, you know, complimentary of his acting ability. And I also heard stories, and we might get into a little bit of this, that Kirk always wanted all the lines, all the good lines, but right. He was the star. So I guess that's just the way it is. So did you ever watch any of the originals? Yeah.
Oh yes. And you know, it wasn't during a time when special effects were that great. So the storylines, they really worked on the storylines and kind of worked around the special effects. They didn't let the special effects carry the show. So the storylines carried the show. I remember when they come back into the Western days, and they're about to get involved in a gunfight. You know, there's some great dialogue that happens there. But yeah, the dialogue is what and the storylines carried it, because they couldn't do special effects like they do today. The movies sometimes rely too much on the special effects and kind of avoid the storyline.
And they also had a message. There was always a message. One of my favorites was when they went back to the 30s, and it was the gangsters, and you know how they got the gangsters together so that they could run the planet together. It was just great stuff. And you got it. It had a storyline, and you're right. It didn't, you know, have to be with special effects and blow-ups and, you know, killing and all that. I always enjoy it. To this day, I can watch any of the episodes, and I still enjoy them. I really do, even though I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So and anyway, go ahead.
It's interesting that you point out that they all had a message. You know, I've developed a couple of series now, and that's the one thing, you know, I learned very quickly that all the successful TV series all revolved of each episode had some kind of message. And I really emphasized that to the writers that I'm working with. I said, you know, what's the message of this episode as we're writing scripts?
And absolutely.
I'm amazed that you picked that out. That's great.
Well, I love any kind of series or any movie that has a message, because it draws you in. You become a part of it because you want to know what's going to happen, and you care about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. We don't see a whole lot of that lately. You know, we just see spectacular stuff. Well, spectacular is okay, but I like the message. I like the old movies from the 30s and 40s because there was a storyline, and you got caught into it, and you wanted to hear what was going to happen and see what was going to happen. Right. Not a whole lot of that lately, but hey, that's called progress, I guess. So anyway, I was also fascinated on how Walter actually got the part of Chekhov. Now, we know why he was cast in it, but there was something else. I personally knew one of the cast members, Marion Collier, on the very popular series back then called Mr. Novak. And Walter surprised me when he said that series was instrumental in his getting Chekhov on Star Trek.
It did indeed. It took 3 years for it to get there.
Really?
And by the way, I played three different characters on three different episodes. I played a rabble rouser who makes all the students go out on strike. I play a cringing accomplice to a beating of a teacher, where I have to confess my guilt. And then I played a Russian student who defected from the Soviet Union and comes to America and has a very rigid idea of how things should work and has a very difficult time adapting to the social environment of a free society. So they're all excellent opportunities. Mm-hmm. In fact, the character that I played, it was the cringing, cowardly one, was perhaps the most satisfying, because who wants to see that in themselves?
Yeah. You know?
Who wants to expose that?
Yeah.
But in surrendering to the demands of the role and letting that happen, I achieved a considerable amount of satisfaction that I didn't protest. I went with it. I allowed myself to examine that.
Sure.
But yes, the thing about playing the Russian and how I was cast three years later is a wonderful illustration, an example the word is capricious, the capricious attitude, the capricious nature of this business.
Okay.
One doesn't necessarily graduate from one role to another, gaining importance as an actor and developing and achieving a higher ring on the ladder as you go.
Yeah.
It's a business with its ups and downs, as everybody knows, your peaks and valleys. And sometimes you get lucky, and sometimes you give it an outstanding audition, and you are not accepted in the role. And all those things happen, and that's what an actor's life is about.
Oh, you betcha.
And the example here is that I read for the part of this Russian, this rigid, state-controlled Russian student. And I read it the way it was written, very much someone who is admonishing this American cultural life and who believes in the dictates of a very structured society. And that's dead on the way it was written. And the director initially was very pleased with it.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as told me that I had the role, and I found this out from the casting director, although he didn't tell me at the moment I read that I was going to play the part, he pretty much was pretty much determined that that's what would happen.
Yeah.
However, the script was not satisfactory. And so they kept reading other actors because the director had nothing else to do, waiting for the script to be rewritten. And they brought in another, and I got this off from the casting director, whose name I will reveal in a moment because that's important to the story. But they brought in another actor, an actor who had done the second lead in a major motion picture, directed by Ilya Kazan, who was actually a Greek young man.
Uh-huh.
And he came in, and he read this is secondhand information, but my casting director friend told me about it. He read it totally differently. He read it in a way that had to be something out of his imagination. It was not there on the page.
Mm-hmm.
Very flamboyant, very much off the wall. A character that I could not justify. So when I was called back in at the end of the week to read, now the director had a change of heart and decided that he wanted me to try to read it the way this other actor had. And knowing that that he wanted me to imitate another actor was very offensive to me.
Sure.
And if I had not known that, but if it had just been the director who had wanted me to, it was his idea, as a challenge, I would have tried.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that he wanted me to imitate another actor,
I'd be ticked off.
I just could not, aesthetically, I could not bring myself to do it. And I told him so. I said, no, I can't read it that way. It's just not there to be had. It's not in the script. And he says, well, if you don't read it that way, you don't get the part. And I said, well, be that as it may, I'm not available aesthetically to read it. And so they cast the other actor. That should have been the end of the story. The other actor was cast to play the Russian. God knows how that would have worked out. And in fact, I was very interested in finding out. And I called my director friend the following Monday and said, look, Joe, I've got to come down and watch this guy work. I've got to find out how he's made this part real, how he could have interpreted in such a different way and made it a viable character. And Joe said to me, oh, I guess you didn't hear. One of our actors, Dean Jagger, has become ill, and they postponed the script. So 6 weeks go by. Dean Jagger is now well. A new director comes in. Joe brings me back. I read one line. Mary, I am not exaggerating.
Yeah.
There is one line. He says, you got the part.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And Joe becomes Joe DiAugusta, the casting director on Mr. Novak, was 3 years later the casting director on Star Trek.
Oh,
and remembering my performance from that other show brought me back in. And that's how I got on Star Trek.
That is amazing. Were you happy with your character on Star Trek?
Yeah. I was happy to play it. I wish there was more to it. Like every actor, you know, you want to do more.
Yeah.
You feel that, you know, you operate at cross current somehow as an actor.
Yeah.
You feel that you have
there's more in you that you can bring out. Sure.
You want to perform. You want to show what you can do, and at the same time, you're always questioning whether you're going to be able to do it successfully. And so, as once I started playing Chekhov, I thoroughly enjoyed the opportunity, but yearned
to have more to do
to actually bring the character to life in a three-dimensional way, which was not really available to me on the series. There were moments here and there, and in a couple of the feature films, I felt there were some satisfying scenes that I got to play. But, you know, you always want to do more.
You know, I've spoken to some of the other characters from Star Trek, and, you know, they said basically William Shatner really wanted to be the star. You know, he would take the lines away from other people if he had to, including Leonard Nimoy. Is that true?
Oh, and I've grown so mellow and sentimental in my old age. But
no, you're young. Come on.
Bill Shatner was the star of the show.
Yeah.
He was the star. The show was funded on the basis of his involvement
and
availability. And he was extremely good in the part. He was a talented actor. He brought a great deal to it. He had an enormous fan following. And he was a talented performer. All of that is absolutely true, and I take none of that away from him. Do I feel the way the others do? And that pretty much involves all the supporting actors. An uncategorical yes.
Okay. That's okay. That's, you know, it's a fact. You know, I'm not saying this is good, bad, or whatever, you know, but it's just is the way it was.
It was the way it was. He took on that responsibility with great joy, perhaps to the unfortunate participation of the other actors.
Some of the others, yeah, of course.
Their lack of involvement. But you can't take away his talent. You can perhaps argue that he might have been a little bit more part of the group,
yeah,
and not so self-involved.
Absolutely. Well, you know, but it was a team. I mean, I cannot picture William Shatner without the rest of you, period.
The thing is, he could.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I got to ask you, though, personally, do you have any hobbies?
Do I have a hobby?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a terribly creative hobby, but I am a collector, and I collect comic character-related memorabilia.
No kidding.
Not comic books, but pinback buttons that go back to 1890, the figurines that go back to the 20s that were made in Germany as well as in the States.
It's cool.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And I started as a kid. As a kid, I was a little bit on the lonely side, as I think I've suggested.
Yeah.
And I needed something that I could focus on that would give me some kind of satisfaction. So I was a hobbyist of things like that. And then I gave it all up when I went to college. And my wife is the source of my returning to all of that. Because she, in 1967, she bought me a birthday present, which was one of the big little books. These are little books that were precursors of comic books.
Yeah.
And they had cardboard covers. And she bought me the first one, and then that set me off.
The rest is history, huh?
The rest is history. Hundreds of books, hundreds of pinback buttons, hundreds of figurines.
Oh, my gosh.
We, in fact, built, and bless her heart for being so generous, we built a second story to our house. Just to house my
kidding. Really?
To house my collection, yeah. And that's why I've been married for 54 years.
Oh, bless your heart. Bless your heart. Now, what makes Walter Koenig happy?
A sense of
accomplishment?
Creative accomplishment. The opportunities are few and far between now as an actor. After all, it just not that many roles for 83-year-olds. I don't get that many opportunities. But I have found a great deal of satisfaction when I have written, and I've written, and when the work is, I consider to be sound. When I wrote the first autobiography, Beaming Up, Walter Koenig, Warped Factor, a Neurotic Guide to the Universe. I found that to be a really pleasurable experience, going over my life, remembering not only the successes but the failures, and seeing them in a different perspective, and being able to find the humor in the things that went wrong, the reader's reaction, that the fact that it was so well received was all very, very pleasant for me. And then in the 70s, I started writing for television. When the work dried up as an actor after Star Trek was canceled, I started writing for television, and I wrote for several different shows. And that was great fun. And so on. I've written a couple of minutes of screenplays for independent films that were made.
That's beautiful. I mean, you're not locked into only doing one thing. So many people are, this is all I can do. I can't do anything else. You've done such, you are so prolific, not only, you know, as an actor, but a writer, a producer. You've done it all. I mean, that's incredible. What an incredible life you've had.
Well, bless your heart, Mary. It hasn't been all roses, you know. There have been, you know, we in the business talk about being at liberty. Oh, which is a euphemism
yes.
for being unemployed.
Yeah, he ain't got a job.
There have been many, many occasions when actually months have gone by when I haven't had an opportunity to apply my craft. In fact, when Star Trek was canceled in 69, I spent the first two or three months waking up in the morning and staring at the ceiling and wondering, well, what was I going to do today? The phone wasn't going to ring. What was I? And really, really a sense of abandonment and the disillusionment.
Walter, unfortunately, we run out of time. Can I please?
Really? I have thought that fast.
I know. And there's so many more things I want to talk to you about. Could I ask you to come back again sometime?
Absolutely. I'm here for your end of day.
It's been fantastic. And thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. And I know, you know, looking back, it's wonderful to look back. But, you know, these stories mean so much to all of us out here who are fans of yours.
Well, thank you very much. And just the final postmortem on all of this is the name of the book is Beaming Up and Getting Off. And it's available through Amazon and through Google and through the publisher. And I hope people will.
Oh, they will.
To read it.
Thank you so much.
And you know what, Ken? It's so interesting talking about all the things. It was during the pandemic. It was either 2021, something like that, when I had him on. But he was married to Judy Leavitt back in 1965. And you mentioned that there was some tragedy in his life. She also, by the way, passed away in 22. So, but they were married for a very long time. Not actually what normally happens in Hollywood, but they did. But they also had a son, Andrew. I think that's what you were alluding to. And he passed away in 2010. Isn't that sad?
Yeah. And he was actually couple of Star Trek episodes.
Yeah,
he was an actor. Yeah,
actor, born in 1968. They were married in 65, and you know, there's sadness for everything. But on a lighter note, I got to tell you, I have Samoyed dogs. You know, you see my dogs, my white fluffy dogs from Siberia, which kind of fits into what we're talking about with Chekhov. And his original name from the breeder was Yukon's Journey Through Time. And so I don't know if I ever told you, but that's the reason we named him Trekker because of that. So all of that fits in. But anyway, we all love Star Trek. We'll always continue to love Star Trek. Right,
Ken? That's right.
And unfortunately, it's that time again to say farewell on Pop Star Talk. Till our next time together. Now, in the meantime, I will search out another fun interview from my past to share with you. Thanks to engineer Greg for his great work in making sure that Pop Star Talk is put together in fine fashion. And of course, my producer, Ken Knoll, for his sharing his insights to all the personalities that we've had on and even those to come. And I thank all of you folks for being with us. And my hope is that you will be with us for many future Pop Star Talk shows. And I want to wish you this special thought. As always, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and always dare to dream.
Produced by AutoVita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.